This is Josh Barrow, and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. It is the second week of January, and this week we did not get ourselves into a wider war with Iran. After last week's airstrike that killed top Iranian General Qasem Soleimani, the Iranians counterattacked, firing missiles at a U.S. military base in Iraq. But the Iranian attack appeared designed to avoid casualties or significant damage, and the president chose to treat Iran's response as seeking an off-ramp from military escalation. He said he would impose further economic sanctions on Iran, but would not undertake a military counterstrike. So far, so good. But Iran also said it would no longer abide by restrictions under the JCPOA, that is, the Iran nuclear deal from which we have already withdrawn. And there is a history of Iranian retaliation other than through conventional military force and on longer timescales than a week. So we will see how that develops. We'll also see what the attack means for our relationship with Iraq, where some lawmakers have been agitating for the removal of American troops. Now let's bring in our left, right, and center panel. As always, I'm your center. I'm joined by Rich Lowry, editor of National Review on the right, and on the left, Elizabeth Brunig of the New York Times. Hello.
Hi, Josh.
Hey, Josh.
So later in today's show, we're going to talk about progress on the impeachment trial, or maybe the lack of progress on the impeachment trial. We'll also look at some developments in the Democratic presidential primary. But let's start with the Middle East. And to talk about that, Jarrett Blanc joins us now. Jarrett is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. When he was at the State Department, Jarrett worked on implementation of the Iran nuclear agreement and sanctions. Before that, he was the acting special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan. Hi, Jarrett. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
So when we launched this surprise attack that killed Soleimani, one of the big fears had been what the Iranians would do in retaliation, whether their attacks could kill Americans or could draw us into a big war that we had not intended to get into. Do the events of the last week with the Iranians seeming to back down, at least for now, in terms of military action, does that cause you to reevaluate those risks at all?
No. I don't think it's hugely surprising that Iran's initial overt reaction was cautious and modulated. My expectation is that there's going to be a long tail of covert responses to the Soleimani attack from Iran, some of which are going to be, you know, more or less egregious. The Iranians have a long menu of things that they can choose from. And we're back to the situation that we were in a week ago, in the sense that there's an unsustainable status quo of crisis. It's just made much worse by the fact that there's some additional blood under the bridge.
Rich, what do you say to that?
No, I think this is clearly a short-term victory, at least for President Trump. It appears the Iranians were just afraid to directly kill Americans and calibrated their attack such that they could say to their people, oh, we've launched this great fuselage against the great Satan without actually harming anyone, because they didn't want to harm anyone because they were afraid of what Trump would do to them next. I take the point, though, that the Iranians do believe that revenge is best served cold. In cases where the Israelis have hit Hezbollah leaders, Iranians have responded in terror attacks 1-2 years later. So this thing isn't fully played out. But the fears were clearly now overblown, and this looks, rather than an inflection point, a continuation of the ongoing contention with Iran over their role in the region and over the nuclear program.
Liz, are you less nervous than you were a week ago?
Not really. I mean, I'm glad that Iran seems to be more rational than we are, at least in not electing to do something that would have led to immediate severe escalation and chaos. But at the same time, there are a lot of other options for responding to the assassination. There are cyber attacks, for instance. There are other areas in the region where the United States has interests, quite wrongly, I think. And then there are, there's just terrorism. There's responses that don't necessarily have to come directly from the Iranian state itself. That we could be inadvertently aggravating. I'm less nervous about an immediate large-scale sort of chaotic escalation, but I don't think I'm any less nervous about the possibility of long-term after effects.
There are two problems, I think, with the way that Rich has laid this out. One is that we in the United States have gotten ourselves into this really crazy short time cycle for news, right? And the rest of the world doesn't work that way. So the fact that X has happened or Y hasn't happened in the first week, the idea that we can then judge that whether there's been a victory or not a victory, it that's just not the way diplomacy and national security works. And the second thing is that Let's step back for a second and look at what the Iranians actually did. So it's not hugely surprising that they shy away from direct conventional confrontation with the United States. They always do. Everyone always does, because doing anything else is insane. But they did launch 20 ballistic missiles from their own territory at bases inhabited by U.S. troops. Now, they did a lot of things to try to be careful about not killing Americans, but they ran. They were willing to run a reasonably high risk of getting something wrong and going to war with the United States in a more overt way than the war that we're now in. So let's not pat ourselves on the back about, you know, whether or not we or they have stepped back from the brink here.
Yeah, I mean, Rich, in terms of dodging a bullet there and in terms of the risk that the Iranians get something wrong, I mean, it looks like they accidentally shot down a commercial airliner, most of the passengers on whom were either Iranians or Iranian Canadians. This was shortly after the exchange of attacks, and it was, you know, the on takeoff from Tehran Airport at a time when you would imagine that Iranian air defenses were on high alert. And so I think that's one of the things that people look at this week and are nervous, that there can be things that go wrong even as people are trying to contain the nature of the conflict that can have unintended consequences and that could lead to things that people didn't expect.
Yeah, I mean, that's certainly true. In fact, that's a truism. But I just don't get the argument that some people who aren't being very careful about what they're saying about this suggest that somehow it was wrong of us to hit Soleimani in retaliation for the killing of Americans for fear that the Iranians might make some horrific, tragic mistake and shoot down an airliner flying out from their own airport. And I just don't get that at all. This isn't honest at all. And I take the point, as I said in my initial comment, that this is a tactical short-term victory, but it clearly shows that the Iranians were nervous about killing Americans. It doesn't mean, they don't have options down the road, but the fears that were consuming the media and a lot of the commentariat in the immediate wake of this, I think, appear pretty clearly unfounded.
Well, I think it's part of a broader theme that we've seen in the Mideast in the last decade plus, right? Is that, you know, when you have conflicts, when you have actions even that take out leaders who are despotic, who may be unpopular with a repressed masses in their country, you can still get very chaotic outcomes with unforeseen terrible consequences for people. And I think that, you know, the question of, do you bear any moral culpability for something that you didn't do, that whoever did it didn't even really intend to do? I think, you know, if we think the U.S. bears some moral culpability for deaths in the Iraqi Civil War, even though we were not, you know, exactly a belligerent in that, you know, we didn't decide that, you know, that insurgents should, you know, should kill other Iraqis, right, and that sort of thing. Still, because it was a consequence of an action that we undertook specifically and that bore a risk of that, I think you can say that there is some moral culpability there, even if you're not pulling the trigger, or even if the people who did it really shouldn't have done it.
Right, but this was a very limited and proportionate attack. You know, we weren't invading Iran not knowing where we would be 6 months from now or years from now in our occupation in Iran. We just took out the guy who's responsible for these kinds of attacks for years and hit just two cars with apparently everyone in the cars, involved in this hierarchy of terror in one way or another. So it just doesn't seem reckless to me. Yes, you know, bad things can happen in the world and accidental things can happen, but the Iranians can consider that as well and stop killing Americans. And of course, they never will. So then we're faced with the various unfortunate choices to how to make them stop doing that or at least do less of it.
Liz, I guess the flip side of that, if we're thinking about knock-on effects, is that, you know, Soleimani had been leading an immensely disruptive force in the region, basically fomenting conflicts in various other countries around the Middle East. And so conceivably, his death may redound in positive ways in terms of the life of ordinary people in Iran and elsewhere in terms of, you know, people he won't cause to be killed.
Maybe. I mean, there's always going to be conflict in the world. I guess the question for Americans thinking about our foreign policy is, what should our role be in the regional conflicts happening in areas that are not the United States? I would tend toward pretty limited, and we shouldn't be an aggravating factor, nor do I think it's necessary that we take it upon ourselves to solve the world's problems or even presume that we can, right? So is it possible for the United States to tactically assassinate everyone in every region of the world who could be causing or at least involved in regional conflicts? Maybe. Is that a wise expenditure of our resources? I don't think so. And I don't think that the American people show a lot of interest in that kind of engagement.
We have a nasty tendency in the way that we assess foreign policy of over-personalizing some of these issues and conflicts. Iran is a modern bureaucratic state. Soleimani was an effective official in that state, but nobody is irreplaceable. And the idea that getting rid of him is going to change or make dramatically less effective Iran's aggressive policy in the region, I think is just really silly. And in fact, I think the administration recognizes that it's silly because they have stepped up security in the region. They've stopped counter-ISIS military efforts out of bases in Iraq because they recognize that even in the short term, the threat is higher because not because the threat has to do with Iranian effectiveness, but because the threat has to do with Iranian willingness. This is more about politics than it is about changing whether or not Iran is capable of carrying out attacks or an aggressive policy.
Can we talk some about some of the ongoing responses aside from this the Soleimani attack? Jared, the president said that he would announce more economic sanctions against Iran. Mike Pompeo on Friday, as we tape, is announcing additional sanctions. How much more room is there to sanction Iran? I feel like this keeps getting ratcheted up over and over again. Are there things that we can do at the margin that put more economic pressure on them? At what point have we sort of maxed out sanctions?
No, there's really nothing meaningful left to sanction. Iran is as isolated from the international economy as it is possible to be. You can continue to pile on new things for symbolic reasons if you want to, but the fundamental pieces are set here. And if the Trump administration is serious, as they claim to be, about wanting to have a negotiation with the Iranians, Tehran has made pretty clear what the price of entry is, and that is a fairly modest form of sanctions relief that would give them some confidence that coming to the table has got some benefit and isn't just domestic political cost. So the risk here is that by piling on new sanctions, you're making it less likely that you have the diplomatic off-ramp that you claim to want.
Yeah, Rich, what do we think is the White House endgame here? I mean, the president has said repeatedly that he's willing to have talks, but the list of demands that Mike Pompeo has made for what Iran should do sort of go against the essence of the last several decades of Iran's regime. And so it's not clear to me what the off-ramp is there for the U.S. to get to a diplomatic solution here. And meanwhile, it seems like a lesson that Iran could take from all of this is they really, really need a nuclear weapon so that the U.S. will not feel free to push them around like this.
Yeah, so I think Trump is probably of two minds, and the administration is of two minds, whether they want to fix the JCPOA or whether they want to nix it entirely. And I do think we learned since the Soleimani killing that, again, this was not a totally different path. They're still on this pressure campaign towards some sort of negotiation, whether negotiation can happen or not, whether their demands are realistic or not. And I think that the downside for Iran is if they decide, well, we're going to actually get weapons, is then they have a united Western world against them again. And the card more immediately on sanctions that the administration has at some point is the so-called snapback, where you snap back the UN sanctions, which economically would not be that much, that materially different from what we're doing now, but it would snap back all these UN resolutions that put the Iranian nuclear program utterly outside the international system and deny them all international legitimacy, and that would be a big deal.
Jared, what do you make of that?
So I think that if the U.S. were to attempt to use the snapback mechanism with no support from anybody else, including our closest European partners, we would do more damage to the legitimacy of the Security Council than we would to the legitimacy of Iran's nuclear program. So I think that's the reason that the Trump administration has stayed away from it so far. As Rich said, it really wouldn't have any appreciable economic effects. And so I don't see it as being a particularly strong or smart card for the administration to play, even within the framework of maximum pressure.
So, sorry, can you explain that a little more? What would, in the event that the administration made this move, it would be essentially trying to act on behalf of the whole Security Council? Basically, you know, what if members of the Security Council object to the idea object to the snapback?
I don't know how nerdy everybody wants to get here, but basically,
it's a welcoming environment for nerdiness.
Okay. All right, so it's a safe space. When we negotiated the JCPOA, We were operating in an environment where there were a number of very, very forceful UN Security Council resolutions condemning Iran's nuclear program. And we were willing to give up those resolutions, but we were concerned that if Iran then cheated on the deal, we wouldn't be able to get Russian and Chinese support to reimpose the same kind of UN illegitimacy that we had achieved over the course of several years before that. And so a very, very clever mechanism was come up with called snapback, which basically, I can describe the procedure if you want, but basically what it means is that any member of the Security Council can force the reimposition of all of these previous resolutions without, not only without a veto, but without actually even needing a majority vote of the other members of the Security Council. So what that meant is that the United States or the UK or France or could just snap their fingers and reimpose all of these old Security Council resolutions. But when this was put in place, the thinking was that it would be Iran potentially starting the violations of the JCPOA. Nobody was really prepared for the U.S. to be the first violator. And so the idea that we would now snap back the Security Council resolutions after being the ones who pulled out of the deal, it's not how any of the countries involved envisioned it. And it would be very, very problematic in a variety of ways that in New York.
Yeah, Liz, this is what seems strange to me about the narrative that, you know, the president wants a way to fix the JCPOA to make it stronger, that he seems to be operating in a way that does not have the coalition that he would need in order to do that.
Right. And nor does he seem to have a real strategy for getting there. I mean, the only thing that I'm seeing out of Trump at this point looks like escalation and a real worsening of relations in a way that is going to make everyone involved less amenable to a diplomatic solution along the lines of strengthening it. So, I'm not super confident here in his ability to do what he's saying he's going to do, which is maybe not a new state of affairs.
The one thing, though, that I see here, and Jared, I'm wondering what you think about this. I mean, hasn't the president demonstrated that the Iranians are desperate to stay within this deal and that they are, in fact, willing to give up more on some terms in order to do so?
I don't think so. I mean, for one thing, as you indicated at the beginning of the program, Iran has already exceeded most of the limitations provided for under the deal. So at this stage, the deal only exists really as a shell to which future diplomats might possibly be able to return, or at least that's true today. It might not be true tomorrow. I don't think that what we've seen from this is that there was a tremendous well of Iranian concessions that we didn't plumb in the Obama administration.
Let's take a break. I will be back with Rich Lowry of National Review, Elizabeth Brunig of The New York Times, and Jared Blanc of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace to talk about Iraq. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing from our left, right, and center, and we want to hear from you, too. Tweet us at LRCKCRW and download the free KCRW app to listen to Left, Right, and Center on demand.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Josh Barrow of New York Magazine. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunig, columnist at The New York Times. And Jared Blanc of the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace is also with us. One of the big risks from the attack on General Soleimani, the one that's gotten the most attention, was how Iran would respond. But there's also the issue of our relationship with Iraq. 17 years after invading, we still have several thousand troops in Iraq. Last time we withdrew from the country entirely, it fell into a civil war that led to the rise of ISIS. And one of the key purposes of our ongoing troop presence has been to prevent ISIS from rising again. But the American troop presence in Iraq is controversial, and it's especially disliked by significant elements in Iraqi politics that are aligned to Iran. Our attack that killed Soleimani on Iraqi soil has given ammunition to those who would demand that the U.S. leave. The Iraqi parliament even cast a non-binding vote revoking permission for U.S. troops to be in the country. Jared, I've been confused about how to interpret this vote and some of the other moves from Iraqi officials in terms of how binding they are eventually likely to be. Is this setting in process something that is going to ultimately have to lead to our withdrawal? Or should we think of a lot of this as posturing for domestic Iraqi political purposes?
So this is speculative, but I think that we're on a track that is likely to lead to a firm Iraqi demand for our withdrawal, which I believe we have to comply with, although the State Department issued a statement just as we were starting to record here suggesting that that we would perhaps not comply with that sovereign demand, which is a very, very strange idea.
Rich, what do you make of that? Does the president have a strategy here, and are we likely to have our position in Iraq severely undermined by this?
Well, it's clearly turned public opinion, at least for the short term here in Iraq, against us, where the pressure had actually been on the Iranians. You know, there have been protests and demonstrators shot and killed, demanding a cessation of Iranian influence in the country. The parliamentary vote is symbolic. There were, you had the Sunni and Kurdish representatives not showing up. The PM, you know, who's been pushing this, prime minister, had already resigned. So there's some question about the legitimacy and the meaning of this action. But there's clearly going to be pressure on us going forward. And this is, you know, a longstanding complaint, but I think one that's true. If you look at the killing of Soleimani, it just speaks to incredibly deft capabilities on the part of the United States. Track the guy, know where he is, hit him in an instant. We need comparable diplomatic and tools of persuasion in a country like Iraq. There's a big argument. There's a big political debate over what's going to happen, and we need to be just as concerned with that as with being able to drone people. So there's a competition that's going to go on, and unfortunately, this is where Iran is much more capable than we are.
Liz, is that desirable if this leads to our withdrawal from Iraq?
Yeah, I mean, I think that may be one of the more desirable outcomes in a situation where all of the outcomes have significant problems, right? We've created a circumstance where there's really no fairy tale ending that's going to make everyone happy and certainly lead to peace or even likely lead to peace. But I think the question for us is, you know, is it really possible for a permanent American occupation to end well? Is it something that's going to continually entangle us in further and greater conflicts? Is it something that's actually going to continue to create tension and agitation in the region? It certainly seems like that at this point. And it just seems beyond the scope of our role as a country in the stage of nations to try to permanently maintain governance in a country that is trying to assert a sovereign government of its own. So, I mean, I understand it's not necessarily in the United States' best interests in the region if the regional powers there end up controlling ISIS in their own way. I understand Soleimani had been very involved in opposing ISIS. And so that might not be what we want to see happen, but neither is it really tenable for us, in my view, to stay and try to limit the rise of groups like ISIS forever. So if we end up pulling out at this point, it may be one of the, you know, at least arguably positive outcomes in a situation where there aren't any great outcomes.
I agree that the U.S. military presence in the broader Middle East is simply not tenable. And the desirable off-ramp here, to use that hackneyed phrase again, is that we manage our departure. And the problem is, if you make tactical decisions like the Soleimani attack that hand sort of the control, the moment-to-moment control to somebody else, and that's where we are right now. Instead of being able to figure out how do we best get out of Iraq in a way that minimizes the risk of, you know, another rise of ISIS or a similar international threat, I think we're going to be reactive to Iraqi domestic politics in a way that's probably not in our best interest.
Rich, you talk about the importance of diplomacy and, you know, the importance of interacting with public opinion in Iraq. I think this is an area where the president's foreign policy instincts have served him very badly, and in particular the way he has talked about the U.S. military presence in Iraq as a bulwark against Iran. That's not a good message for the Iraqis. That's not a message about how it's in their interest. Some of them even have relatively favorable feelings toward Iran. But it's basically outside the president's emotional capability to talk about our military presence there as important for promoting stability in Iraq, for putting down insurgencies, for stopping the rise of ISIS, and talking about how that is good for Iraqis. He's not really making the case about why you should be willing to host our troops. Instead, he talks openly about it almost as though Iraq were a colony. I mean, and it's related to talk about, you know, you go into these places and you take the oil. Even if that's not a policy that he is implementing, right. It certainly seems like something that deeply undermines the ability to have the cooperation of democratically elected officials and of publics in countries like this.
Yeah, so obviously, I mean, the talking about taking their oil or talking about we're going to impose stiff sanctions on them if they make us leave because they need to pay us back for this airbase we've supposedly invested a lot of money in. All that obviously is absurd and hugely counterproductive. I'm not sure the message that we're in Iraq as a bulwark against Iran is a bad message for Iraq per se. It's a good message for some Iraqis and a very bad message for other Iraqis, which goes to the deeper problem with Iraq. And, you know, Mike Pompeo and others have talked about how they want Iraqis to decide the future of Iraq, which is something actually the Iranians don't want. So I think that is a useful avenue for public diplomacy to hit that message.
Can we talk about this resolution that passed the House of Representatives under the War Powers Act? It's supposed to prevent President Trump from attacking Iran, except in case of an imminent threat against the United States. I think this conversation is largely theoretical because I don't expect this resolution to pass the Senate. Rich, it's interesting to me that one of the three Republicans who broke with the White House to vote for this resolution was Matt Gaetz, who's the congressman from North Florida, who's ordinarily one of Trump's closest allies. And what he said basically was that he thought the strike against Soleimani was a good idea in U.S. interest, but that getting into a wider war with Iran would be a bad idea. Interesting to me that he basically stood so alone in the party in saying that.
Yeah, so he's a more pure non-interventionist. And you've seen this tension in the Trump coalition between kind of the more traditional Republican interventionists who like the killing of Soleimani because it's pushing back against Iran. Then you have the Jacksonians who don't care that much about the world unless there's a threat to us, in which case they favor a fierce response, and they favor this attack. And then you have the real non-interventionists, Tucker Carlson and others, who are really concerned and worried about this. So, because they just think we shouldn't be involved in the Middle East at all, and this risks getting even a deeper involvement. So Matt Gaetz speaking from that part of the party. But this resolution is meaningless. Congress does have a big say, ultimately, in these sort of interventions. But the play, if you really wanted to do something about it, would be denying funding for our troops to be in Iraq anymore. And Congress has used this power in the past, famously in Vietnam, in the Mexican-American War, when Polk wanted to go fought further, Congress wouldn't fund it. And the Iraq War and the Bush years, the pressure in Congress around funding affected his policy. So that's how, if you really wanted to do something, but there's not a big enough consensus for that, and this is just symbolic posturing.
Yeah, Liz, I think a lot of people on the left have been concerned about whether we're seeing a repeat of 2002 or 2003, where you see a military action by the executive branch in the Middle East that sort of swells public support, where politicians fear what it will mean for them politically if they oppose the action. And it doesn't look to me like we're really seeing that. I mean, first of all, as Rich noted, while the president retains broad support in his party, he's getting warnings from a significant fraction of it, if not in Congress, at least in the media. And, you know, Tucker Carlson keeps devoting the 8 o'clock hour on Fox News to the unwiseness of future of further escalation with Iran. And then we've also started to see polling. There was a USA Today Ipsos poll which found by about 2-1, Americans think that the attack on Soleimani made us less safe rather than made us more safe. It doesn't look to me like there is, you know, likely to be a rally around the flag effect that encourages further military escalation.
Yeah, I don't see it happening just yet. I was the ripe old age of 12 when we went into Iraq. And I can still remember living in Texas at the time, what seemed like completely unanimous, both just sort of community, social, organic support for that military action. And then in the media, it was not typical in my recollection to see a whole lot of vocal opposition. In fact, vocal opposition to the war at the time was pretty marginalized, at least where I was. And I believe in a lot of mainstream media, people who were anti-war were not only, you know, construed as unpatriotic, but also impractical and a little bit ridiculous and kind of malevolent in the wake of 9/11. And I don't see that happening now. And I think it's a testament to the success left critics have had, you know, criticizing the actions in Iraq and Afghanistan in the subsequent years. Like you said, it's been a long time. nearly two decades at this point. And I think it's become sort of common knowledge and generally accepted that, enormous mistakes were made, lies were told. This was even a platform of Trump's campaign in 2016. And I think that that's something that the left should consider a victory of sorts, right? That we were able to establish this view of that kind of military engagement. And if it is successful in preventing an organic a swell of support for this intervention, then I think that'll be a big accomplishment.
Jarrett, do you see political lessons here for people who want to get this relationship with Iran back onto more of a diplomatic track? What are the right strategies within U.S. politics right now in order to do that?
So I'm not sure that I see domestic political lessons. I think the diplomatic lessons, the international political lessons, are pretty clear, right? So Rich said a minute ago that the United States wants Iraq to make sovereign decisions and Iran does not. But literally just now, the State Department issued a statement saying that the Prime Minister of Iraq had asked us to send a delegation to Baghdad to talk about withdrawal. This, by the way, a prime minister is a longtime friend of the United States. And that our reaction was that any delegation coming to Baghdad would be only to talk about force posture and not withdrawal.
Rich, what do you say to that?
Yeah, I mean, that's not the best thing to say, likely, but there's going to be a negotiation and about what our ultimate status there is in Iraq. But we're not in Iraq shooting down demonstrators. We're not in Iraq creating proxy guerrilla forces. We're not in Iraq trying to push out assassinate or threaten with force political leaders we don't like. So if there is any whisper of a moral equivalence between what we're attempting to do in Iraq and the Iranians, I totally reject that.
Well, I mean, I think they would completely reject the equivalency as well. So maybe that's fair. Either countries have a right to self-determination or they don't. And this is sort of a tension in American thought about our own liberal democracy versus everyone else's own right to determine the course of their national destiny. I don't see any reason to doubt Iran's capability to manage its own affairs. Like Jared said, it's a modern bureaucratic state. It's a big country. It's a country with infrastructure and with a military and with military capabilities. And it seems to be able to govern itself. Are there internal critics? Yes, there are internal critics in the United States, very, very vocal ones. Do they have serious social problems? Yes. Do we have serious social problems? Yes. You don't want to get down to would you want to live there, but would necessarily all of the citizens there want to live here? I mean, and I'm not a relativist. I'm not arguing that there are not distinctions to be made morally between the actions of the two governments. There are. But what I'm saying is I just don't believe that continued American military pressure or even the severity of sanctions is going to improve conditions for them or for us.
But wait, I'm saying, do countries have a right to self-determination or do people have a right to self-determination? I mean, Iran is not truly a democratic country. They have elections, but the public policy is not controlled by popularly elected officials. So I don't think that we can look at actions taken by the Iranian state and impute to that the idea that this is a reflection of the will of the Iranian people.
Well, I mean, it's difficult to determine what the will of a people is. You can do that to some degree with a democracy. Like you say, they do have democratic elements. But what are we going to do about that? How are we going to export democracy? And maybe a better question is, how's that working out for us? How are our efforts to export democracy working besides like creating ISIS? That was one major byproduct of our noble quest to give everyone liberal democracy. It might well be the case not everyone wants liberal democracy and that not all cultures are suited to liberal democracy. And so in that case, determining the course of their national destiny may not involve a liberal democracy or governance that looks identical to ours. I don't know if that justifies American military intervention, or even if it did, whether American military intervention would actually advance the cause of liberal democracy in those cases.
Jared, I'll give you the last word here if you would like it.
There are a lot of memories here from 2002, 2003, and I think there's good news that American politics is responding to this very, very differently from what I recall in 2002 and 2003. This little end of the debate, though, is alarmingly similar to the one that we had 20 years ago. The United States does much better in terms of our own national security when we take the world as it is. So is Iran a good government? No. Is it an adversary to the United States? Yes. Is it bad for its own people? Sure. If we want to advance the interests of the United States, we need to find ways to deal with adversaries like that short of military interventions. And if we don't, then we're going to continue on the path that we're on right now, which is a tremendous loss of blood, a tremendous loss of treasure, and an increase in the kind of social fissures in the United States that are attributable at least in part to the wars that we've been fighting unnecessarily for the last generation.
Jarrett Blanc is a senior fellow at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. Jarrett, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
I've been talking with Liz Brunig of the New York Times and Rich Lowry of National Review. We will be back to talk about impeachment. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
You're hearing civilized yet provocative opinions from all sides. Now we need to know what you think. Tweet us at LRCKCRW. Stream all episodes of Left, Right, and Center and our companion show, All the President's Lawyers, at kcrw.com/podcasts or from the KCRW app.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm your host, Josh Barrow. On the right is Rich Lowry, editor of National Review. On the left is Elizabeth Brunick, columnist at the New York Times. Congress is back in Washington and is still fighting over the terms of an impeachment trial. Mitch McConnell says he doesn't need Democratic buy-in on structuring the trial. He has the Republican votes he needs to proceed as he wishes. And he also says he won't disclose trial rules before Nancy Pelosi sends him articles of impeachment. Pelosi has said she needs to know the rules so she knows who to appoint as impeachment managers. She also wants Republicans to agree to an open process with witnesses. But as we tape on Friday, it looks like she is making plans to send the articles over next week, even without what she wanted from McConnell. I think all three of us have been scratching our heads about this from the beginning. What did Nancy Pelosi think she was going to achieve by withholding the articles of impeachment? And some Democrats, especially in the Senate, also seem to be scratching their heads, saying openly that they would like her to send the articles and get on with it. Liz, do you understand what Pelosi was up to here?
No, I don't. I'm not sure it's ever been a logical threat to not send Mitch McConnell something he doesn't want. Until he agrees to your terms, it's sort of driving a hard bargain with nothing. I think that, you know, to the degree that Democrats think that this conflict in Iran was an intentional distraction from impeachment proceedings, I mean, I guess that's possible. I don't know how intentional Trump is about these things or even how within his control the timeline is. But, you know, it seems to have been somewhat successful. And so I'm not sure that if the House was relying on a public demand mounting to pressure McConnell into agreeing to their terms before receiving the charges, that's actually going to happen. So I'm not really sure what's going on there.
I mean, I think the flip side to this, Rich, is that it's not clear to me what costs there have been to Democrats of hitting the pause button here. I mean, at some point you expected that the talking point would be, well, Democrats are afraid to actually have the trial. They didn't really want to impeach. Did they even really impeach? I think this looks like sort of boring congressional procedure stuff. It's not clear to me that it's really punched through as a story and that when the articles do get sent, then we'll just pick up where we left off. So maybe if this was cost-free to Pelosi, it was, you know, it was a free roll. You know, maybe the president will freak out about the idea that the trial is being delayed and he'll call Mitch McConnell up and demand that he give the Democrats what they want so the trial can start. And that didn't work, but maybe it was worth a shot.
Yeah, I think that's the best case for it is you want to get past the vote in the House as soon as possible to get past the main pain point for moderate Democrats. And then after that, you're in the free because, look, he's not going to get convicted one way or the other. So you kind of hold it and maybe something comes up. I do think it is personally, I don't know whether she'll feel it this way, but it just seems to me humiliating to her because it is completely fruitless enterprise, and it was clear to everyone that she got nothing. But it's not going to move the new needle on impeachment. I don't think it makes, you know, witnesses more or less likely. And I think we probably won't see witnesses, even John Bolton, because I think there's a mutually assured destruction aspect to witnesses that if you get any witnesses that the Democrats would like, Republicans will want their witnesses, and then you're going down the Hunter Biden trail. So I think McConnell's play here is go with the procedure that was set out for the Clinton impeachment, have 2 weeks or whatever devoted to these opening arguments, and then just hope everyone, especially your colleagues, are just kind of sick of it and want to move on, and then therefore there's no appetite for witnesses.
I think people are very focused on that precedent from 20 years ago, and there's even the parallel of a Mideast military attack right in the context of impeachment, which allows us to directly compare some polling. That USA Today Ipsos poll that I mentioned earlier that asked people about the attack that killed Soleimani asked if people thought the president had done it in order to distract from impeachment. And 47% of Americans said yes, which significantly outstripped the no answers, which was in the high 30s. When people were asked that about Bill Clinton 20 years ago, the numbers were very different. Only about 30% of the public was prepared to say that Bill Clinton had attacked Iraq as a distraction. And I think this sort of loops back around to the idea that, you know, maybe after 2 weeks, everyone will just want to get the trial over. It was like that in 1999 because Democrats didn't want Bill Clinton to be impeached. And Republicans knew that impeachment was disastrously unpopular and thought that it had been part of the reason that they actually managed to lose seats in the midterm election in the sixth year of a Democratic president. I don't think Democrats feel those same political imperatives that Republicans felt 20 years ago. Impeachment is not wildly popular. But it polls, you know, somewhere around even, which is a lot better than the impeachment of Clinton 20 years ago. And there's a lot of enthusiasm among Democrats for more of this process, for, you know, I think a lot of, you know, Democratic primary voters would like to hear from witnesses.
Yeah, I think clearly the polling was much better for Clinton. Clinton was just more popular than Trump, even at the outset, you know, before impeachment got rolling. But just anecdotally and from the coverage, it just doesn't seem as though, yeah, if you ask Democratic voters, should be witnesses, yeah, I'm sure that they'll all say yes. But is this really something that's motivating them? Is it something they're asking all the candidates about on the trail? There seems to be very little indication of that, which just goes to me how this whole affair, it's not like this momentous national crisis that's gripping everyone in the country. It's mostly a congressional kind of media political activist complex thing that no one will really kind of notice very much once it goes away.
So, Liz, what have you been watching in the Democratic primary campaign over the last week?
Yeah, it's been an interesting week. Things are still pretty fluid in the early primary states. It looks like Biden is holding pretty strong with a few points of lead in most of those early primary states. His campaign has said they don't really need Iowa or New Hampshire. So if those go to Bernie, and it looks like there's a real possibility that they may, then he'll still be okay because they're counting on a big surge in South Carolina. Interesting things are going on in South Carolina, where Biden has a significant lead. And in second place is someone you probably wouldn't guess, Tom Steyer. And I can't really make a lot of sense of that, except that he has spent quite a bit of money on TV ads in South Carolina. So these strategies for these campaigns are starting to shape up. And I think that one thing that's also taking place is that Bernie is beginning to be treated as a serious front runner for this primary by a lot of major outlets. In the meantime, Elizabeth Warren has continued that polling slump from that high point she had been at, showing her in second and first place in some of those early primary states. And with that has come quite a bit of criticism from her supporters for how the media has treated her and for how she has been treated by Bernie's base, the left flank of the party. It does seem like those two candidates should be able to, you know, have some kind of pact or something like that, just to make sure that one progressive winds up winning the primary. But instead, it looks like Elizabeth Warren is perhaps going to be looking at Julian Castro, who's recently dropped out of the running as a VP pick.
It's funny. I'm trying to remember who said this on Twitter a few months ago. People talk about Joe Biden running a zombie campaign. And this person was like, yeah, it's a zombie campaign because it's going to devour everything in its path. He continues to be in the lead. I was struck. These two Fox News polls came out on Thursday from South Carolina and Nevada. And they found Joe Biden leading in both. Joe Biden leading by about 20 points in South Carolina. And what does anybody talk about in the polls? They talk about Tom Steyer, mm-hmm. Who has managed to get himself into the low double digits because he has blanked
blanketed the airwaves in South Carolina and Nevada, and the other candidates have not been there in the way that they've been in Iowa and New Hampshire getting right. free media. It's really remarkable. I mean, some of the major campaigns, like Elizabeth Warren's campaign, have spent only like $3 or $4 million on TV advertising so far. So it's, you know, that power of that large amount of advertising can get you somewhere up into the single digits in a state where you are basically unopposed on the air, except by Mike Bloomberg. But I think, you know, it's weird to me how people sort of gloss over the story here, which seems to me, you know, if you know, especially Nevada, where, you know, if there is this Bernie surge, and I'm not seeing that in the national polls. I mean, Bernie has been in second place in the polls most of the time, and that's significant. He could win the nomination. His relative standing has improved because Elizabeth Warren's poll numbers have fallen, but it's not. I don't see the surge there. And if there were a Bernie surge, it seems to me like he ought to be in the lead in Nevada, especially, you know, since one of the things that people will say about him is that he's supposed to have especially strong Hispanic support.
Yeah. So on Steyer, it just seems to me, I could be wrong, both Steyer and Bloomberg, they're not buying support; they're buying poll numbers. Because Bloomberg, there's the one poll about a week ago that had him 11 nationally. He's just bought that. But how real is that when you're going to lose all the first four contests that you're not even competing in? Same thing with Steyer. How real is, you know, mid-teen support in South Carolina when you're also been spending a lot in Iowa and New Hampshire, not move the needle in places where the other candidates, as you point out, are intensely competing? So Biden being the zombie candidate, it may prove to be true, just that the big doubt about that is both Iowa and New Hampshire, where he's right there with the other top contenders, but he easily could lose both places, you know, and could finish third or even fourth place in both places. So what does that do to him if that actually happens? But as we've discussed previously, he's in a better position. He's a national poll leader. And if he wins Iowa or New Hampshire, it makes his odds of winning the nomination go really high, and he still has options if he loses in the right way in both of those places.
Yeah, I mean, I think it depends a lot on what the margins are. I mean, the way the polls look right now is that it's likely to be close, that he'll either win by a little bit or lose by a little bit in Iowa and New Hampshire. And what I expect that he will say immediately out of that, if he's 3 points behind Bernie Sanders in Iowa, is he'll say, well, I'm able to get about to a tie in a state that's almost entirely white, and I have way more black support than any other candidate, and therefore that makes clear that I'm going to be in a clear national lead, and so I think that will help him with the narrative as he goes towards South Carolina to say, you know, I do not have a collapsing campaign. In fact, I continue to have the strongest campaign of any of these candidates, and so I think, you know, obviously if he completely tanks in Iowa and he gets 9% of the vote there, then obviously that's a real problem for him. But I don't think that's the likeliest outcome here. Liz, I was wondering what you make of the partnership between Elizabeth Warren and Julian Castro. I mean, even the Warren campaign even having campaign signs with Julian's name on them. Are they trying to preview a ticket here?
Yeah, I mean, that would be my assumption. Warren recently had Castro on stage with her at a rally, and they decided to do double selfies. which, if you've been following Warren's campaign, is a significant part of her pitch, that she has the most demotic approach to campaigning because she's willing to do selfies with lots and lots of people. So bringing Castro in for the double selfie did seem to indicate that he is soon to be, if not already internally, part of the official Warren camp.
We've reached that time once again for our famed left, right, and center rants featuring pet peeves from across the political spectrum. Rich Lowry, it's your soapbox.
Conservative thinker Yuval Levin has a new book coming out about the importance of institutions and how important it is that we allow them to shape us and affect our view of our duties and obligations beyond our personal interest. Someone should send a copy immediately to the Duke and Duchess of Sussex.
Elizabeth Brunick, what's your rant?
Elizabeth Warren, in a campaign stop, recently did a kind of weird dance on stage. It reminded a lot of people of Hillary Clinton's odd turn dancing on Ellen DeGeneres' show back in the day, and there was plenty of comparison to be made on Twitter, with a Cory Booker weighing in to claim that the people criticizing Elizabeth Warren's awkward dancing were criticizing her and not his awkwardness for reasons that you were supposed to infer. Cory Booker, come on, man. People criticize you plenty for being extremely awkward, weird, and kind of robotic. I don't think you're lacking in criticism on that front. And I also don't see the Booker campaign coming back from the dead because they're latching on to Elizabeth Warren's coattails.
For my rant, the Washington Post ran a very strange story this week saying Republican Congresswoman Elise Stefanik had included an altered photo of Speaker Nancy Pelosi in a fundraising appeal. But the photo wasn't altered like the one Republican Congressman Paul Gosar had tweeted a few days earlier that purported to show Barack Obama shaking hands with Iranian President Hassan Rouhani. The photo showed that because Rouhani's face was photoshopped on top of the face of former Indian Prime Minister Manmohan Singh. No, the photo of Pelosi was just altered in the way that photos of political opponents have been altered in attack ads for decades, by filtering it to make it look unflattering. They turned up the contrast to emphasize her wrinkles, which was not nice, but it's also not new, and it's not an alarming disinformation campaign. It's just politics. And the reaction to it reflects how a lot of people in the media and in democratic politics have lost it, looking for a deep fake around every corner and convinced that when they lose influence or power, it must be because some malevolent, probably Russian force is hacking the minds of the American electorate. As we saw in 2018, elections are still won and lost through normal politics. Don't take your eye off the ball by focusing on photo filters. That's all we have time for today. I want to thank Rich Lowry, Liz Brunig, and Jart Blanc. Left, Right, and Center is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us, and tune in next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download and subscribe at kcrw.com/LRC, the KCRW app, or wherever you find podcasts. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.